Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Imagine for a moment that a double glazing salesman comes to your door to offer you advice on your windows, but you can't escape the feeling that his real intention is in fact to burgle your house. You feel deeply ashamed of yourself in case you're wrong and have misrepresented him to yourself. But what if he is in fact a burglar and his real mission is not to help you with your windows, but to steal all that you value and treasure? Which brings us to the Synodal Way, and in particular the document Instrumentum Laboris, the latest part of the consultation process which has just been published and is due to be given consideration throughout as much of the gathered church as cares to engage with it. A friend suggested that when preparing to examine the document, I might try to find some things to compliment it for, as a way of being overtly even-handed. And there are things to compliment it for. It has a very nice section on getting to understand the Catholic Oriental churches better for those who don't know them. Credit where it's due. But beyond acknowledging that, the exercise does feel like trying to find nice things to say about the way the burglar who's come to your door is dressed. A taste in natty ties, no doubt, but his sartorial sophistication is no real consolation for losing all that you value to him. So what appears to be wrong with Instrumentum Laboris? Given that the language a document is set in will affect the categories of thought and the conclusions of the analysis it contains, this document has a deep structural flaw. The language is a mixture not of theology, but what we might call the psychopolitical. It focuses on feelings about belonging, alienation, and progressive concerns about economics and social justice, and of course climate change. One troubling element in its methodology is trying to do theology according to what the reader feels a hypothetical person presented in the text may be feeling. There's a real difficulty in managing life by wondering what somebody else is feeling about something. It presumes too many things that can't be taken for granted: their sanity, their goodness, their judgment, their grasp on reality, their psychic and psychological health. And it's a symptom of the way in which subjectivity has captured so much of our public discourse, from the criminal law to hate crime, from politics to history. Additionally, it's irritating, to say the least, to find that the document relies on the continental stage of the synodal process to supposedly set a number of precedents, when the main numbers who contributed to that were progressive activists, and it was largely ignored by the Catholic world in general. What kind of precedent does that set? Which brings us back to the double-glazing salesman or burglar. This kind of strategy of pseudo-consultation that the synodal process is pursuing is just the same strategy that highly skilled political activists pursue in other walks of life when they're trying to take over an organisation. Burglary. Are my political suspicions and analytical conclusions well-founded or mistaken? Is the double-glazing salesman there to help with the windows or to burgle the house? I asked Edward Pentin, a Rome correspondent for over 13 years, to share his analysis and his perspectives, and he joins me now. Edward, it's very good to see you again. I always feel so reassured when I see you. I feel here is somebody who actually, first of all, knows what he's doing, and secondly, knows what's going on. But that's reassuring initially, depending on the message that you bring. But let's see what the message you bring is. So first of all, thank you for being here. It's good to see you again.
Sure. Pleasure to see you, Kevin.
We had a brief email exchange on the latest working document and discovered that the hairs on the back of our necks stood up in more or less the same way. and that both encouraged and depressed me. It depressed me because I'd like to have thought I was wrong, but it encouraged me that my judgment is not failing altogether. My sense of having read this was an increasing move from frustration to anger. And the anger was to do with the fact that I no longer think that the language and the categories of the synodal process are an accidental effervescence of a certain theological or social culture. Up until now, it reminded me a little bit of when I used to go to Teze for a couple of decades, and the French monks there would write existentially fruitful questions for disturbed late adolescents. And for a while, I've been seeing the synodal process as a sort of slightly less juvenile version of that. But I'm beginning to think that the authors know exactly what they're doing and have plotted a course to a particular end result. Do you share my sense of authorial intent?
This is what I've heard really for the last 10 years, Gavin, in the sense that these synods seem to have, or clearly have in the end, a definitive goal. They want to achieve something out of them. And the more they keep protesting and saying there's no agenda, which Cardinal Hollerich, the general relator of the synod, has said, I think the more they protest, the more people think, well, is there an agenda? Because they seem so adamant that there isn't. But the evidence suggests that there is. Now, of course, this seems to go back to the synod on the family, the two synods on the family in 2014 and 15. And I wrote a book about that and the rigging of that synod, at least the perceived rigging. And I think when I finished that book, I think the consensus was that there was a certain rigging going on and that there was a definitive goal that they had in mind and to achieve an agenda. And that agenda appears to be very much a liberal one, of course, one in which the church's teaching can't be changed, but the church's practice can, pastoral practice can. And from the very beginning, that was pointed out by the late professor from the John Paul II Institute, whose name escapes me right now, but he made the point clearly that they were trying to make this dichotomy, this false dichotomy between the church's doctrine and pastoral practice. And they said, you know, we're not changing the church's doctrine, but we must make the pastoral practice more compassionate to reach out to these people and help them more pastorally. And he pointed out that this is a classic sort of Marxist approach, one in which you make this division in order to achieve a change in the church's doctrine without actually officially changing it. And so we've seen that process go on throughout these synods, most notably through the family synod, but also through the youth synod as well, to some extent. And I think we're going to see it especially during this synod on synodality.
Somebody pointed out to me that the great heresies of the first millennium were to do with the nature of God and of the incarnation. And that what we have in the third millennium are heresies to do with anthropology. So we're discussing what people are and the very nature of personhood. The thing that's made me cross, I think, is to enlarge upon what you've just said, is that instead of saying these ethical standards have to be kept and we mustn't contradict them, let's take burglary, for example. We can't possibly say that burglary is right when the whole of Christian tradition says burglary is wrong. But what we might do is to say that burglars may not intend to be burglars. Their burglaring may be due to all kinds of reasons, which we suspend judgment on. But what we want to do is to allow burglars to feel they can be part of the Christian community. And to do that, we're going to need to listen to them, and often a degree of therapeutic affirmation, and to draw them in from the margins so they no longer feel excluded as burglars, but that despite their burglary, we can make them feel valued as neighbors. And as we listen to them and journey with them and welcome them in from the margins, so we bring in more burglars into our community. And burglary begins almost to be an aspect of our community makeup, because we've invited the burglars in. At no point did we say to them, you need to stop being burglars. But it seems to me that one of the things in the Gospels is that Jesus says to people, if you want to accompany me, you need to stop being whitewashed sepulchres, liars, hard-hearted adulterers. But there is in the document, Instrumentalis Laboris, a moment when they say, like our master, we want to offer unlimited approbation to all human beings. And I thought, this is the most dreadful thing. This is not what Jesus did at all. And there is no sense in the document that any change of behavior is required from anyone who wants to be listened to or accompanied. This must be deliberate. It must be an attempt to say, we'll get nowhere if we talk about the ethics of burglary. We have to therefore talk about the affirmation of burglars and how they feel about themselves. There's this extraordinary notion that you know, as we've talked to burglars, I'm using burglars as a catch-all phrase for other ethical groups, let the reader understand. But as we talk to burglars, we discover they do not feel very welcome in the church, because the church has always had this single monochrome view about what they do that is wrong. Yeah.
And therefore, in order to make them burglars feel welcome in the church, we're going to downplay our ethics. That's the closest they get to telling you the truth about they're about. And this is, therefore, a deception. What would it be in Latin? It would be something like instrumentatum deceptionis.
Yes. No, but that's true. And it's almost as though for the past 10 years, we've been hearing this, you know, we've got to welcome. And we've also been waiting for that sort of reaffirmation of the church's teaching, but it never seems to come. I mean, it comes in sort of cloaked ways or deceptive ways, you know, language which is, you would have to look hard to find it. But we never really get that sort of reaffirmation of the church's teaching in a strong way, saying, yes, you're welcome, but the but never comes. As you say, it works as a sort of affirmation of their sin. And you wonder, that's not pastoral. So what are they up to? And I think that's been the concern of many of the more conservative cardinals, especially the Dubia cardinals, of course, because they seem to be putting all that moral theology aside and not reinforcing the church's teaching at the same time.
If one goes into the document, Instrumentatum Laboris, it says the problems that need solving, too much war, too much climate change, and unjust economics. Mm. And this is purely and completely a left-wing progressive agenda. It's a political agenda. The notion that there's too much war, there is no suggestion that this is to do with the fall, and that the fall, therefore, needs to be addressed by the church.
Right.
The notion that the climate change is enormously contested. Of course, the climate is changing. It always has done. But the rate it changes and what's making it happen, these are scientific questions that although consensus is pretended at, doesn't actually exist and doesn't automatically require a particular theological approach. And as for unjust economics, you couldn't get more partisan in terms of left-right. The right will say that capitalism has lifted more people out of poverty in the last 20 years than ever before in the history of the world. And yet all this document does is talk about unjust economics and unjust migration. It's simply a piece of left-wing political propaganda.
And as I wrote a piece, Gavin, I think it was it last year, where I looked at the people behind this, putting this document together, all these documents, not necessarily this one, but the synod documents on the continental stage. And I think the vast majority of them, they've gone on record giving out these political views of very leftist political views, and also, you know, pushing for women's ordination and married priests and so forth. And so the whole agenda was quite clear, because the people behind the documents, who were writing these documents and drafting them, all come from that particular background. So yes, it's definitely that slant there. Many would argue it's more political than spiritual. And there's no real call, also I noticed in this working document, for any reasoned debate. You know, you can say anything and we'll listen. But what about, you know, if it's within the realms of reason, or of course faithful to the church's teaching? That never really comes up in the document. And I think that's obviously a concern to many of the faithful, I would say.
The whole structure is essentially therapeutic all the way through. The solution to any angst is, well, this requires two things, listening and walking together, whatever walking together actually means. I mean, God knows what I mean, it doesn't mean anything, of course. It's intended to convey some kind of fuzzy mutuality, irrespective of where you're going or how you're going.
Well, there's no destination.
There's absolutely no destination. Again, it's all process and not destination. It's all subjective and not objective. It wouldn't matter quite so much if there was an attempt to mix it. I mean, there's no doubt at all that the Catholic Church is in very serious crisis, and there are a great many things that need dealing with. I mean, the clerical sexual abuse, clericalism, financial abuse, lack of accountability. And it would be really wonderful if the synodal process threw up the means of diagnosing these difficulties and talking about them. One of the things that makes me a Catholic is the experience of the church in holiness over the years. As one looks at the Counter-Reformation, for example, the people who had the most profound effect on the church were people whose lives were steeped in an evident and very potent holiness. and a holiness that appears to be easier to gauge than in Protestantism. Again, one of the things I was surprised about as an Anglican was I really couldn't find any consensus on what holiness was or how it could be achieved. It seemed to be sort of something slightly accidental and very much dependent upon the tribe that you were theologically attuned to. The great glory of Catholicism are the saints, the lives of the saints, the miracles of the saints, the example of the saints, the supernatural phenomena of the saints. It's extraordinary to me that Catholic spirituality doesn't appear anywhere in this. It's purely political and therapeutic.
Yes, and also the whole aspect of holiness being in many ways separate from the world, that you have to be not caught up in the world in such an extent that you become corrupted by it, and the holiness has to be certainly in some ways separate from that. But this is very much taking you very much into the world and into sort of worldly affairs and worldly thinking. I think that's what a lot of criticism has been about with this, that it's, as you say, it's a sort of more of a sort of sociological, almost a scientific sort of document rather than a spiritual one.
Certainly an economic and political document. Well, one of the things I don't understand, again, is for those of us who've come as converts, we've looked at Protestantism in the 20th century and the experimentation with it in terms of spirituality and theology and modernism and different kinds of biblical scholarship. And it's very clear what works and what doesn't work. And the progressive agenda has been disastrous for the Protestant churches and has not done what people hoped it might do in their slight enthusiastic naivety, which is to provide some form of overlap that makes it easier for people to approach Jesus and to approach the life of the kingdom. In fact, it's had the other effect. People have slipped out of authentic Christianity into the modernist agenda. So if one looks at that, and then one looks at the chaos of what's going on in terms of progressive politics with the whole transactivism debate, and even the incoherence between LGB and T, which is now breaking out, L and T being seriously at odds with each other, how is it possible that commentators within the Catholic theological tradition, theologians are supposed to be intellectuals, haven't seen the trajectory of the intellectual manifestos that they're building this process on and discovered that the terminus is broken, it doesn't work, there is no terminus to arrive at for the church?
Oh, I think one argument is that there's been a sort of Protestantization, of course, of the Catholic Church in the sense that it has become less about objective truth and more about subjectivity and sentimentalism and feelings and what feels good and so forth is true. And that I think has been part of this process. And I think there has been a general push within these synodal through these synodal models to sort of make things more Protestant, rather like, of course, the Anglican synod and the way that works. And I think there is a sort of parallel there with trying to democratize the church and try to get it into a more human-centered rather than a God-centered church. And that, of course, has been a dynamic that's existed, especially since the council. I think that's there has been this general horizontalization, if you like, of the church rather than a Christ-centered Christological one. And you see, and I think that's why some people say the synod is, which is basically a natural fruit of that. This is a sort of natural consequence of that process. And you're seeing it very much in this synod particularly.
It's a great surprise to me that people who see how Anglican synodal process works would ever want to implement it. It produces the lowest common denominator. It turns pooled ignorance into a political project that can be pushed through simply by votes and party spirit. But one of the things that I rather hoped we might hear for is that some of the cardinals will look at what's happening to Catholicism. And there's a great deal to be said for traditional Catholicism meeting the needs, almost the famine of transcendence and the miraculous in the lives of young people. What are the chances of some of the cardinals looking at Pope Francis's agenda and Archbishop Fernandez's backing up of it and saying, this doesn't work, we've looked elsewhere, we know it doesn't work, it's a category error, we need to get back up doing what the Catholic Church has been good at, which is developing tradition, maintaining holiness, and converting the world rather than being converted by the world? Is there any hope that the cardinals may decide that this experiment in progressive modernity is not going to lead anywhere useful to Christianity.
I'd like to think there was, but I think because it's the Pope who's leading this, and I think they feel, you know, he's the Pope, but we can't go against him. He's got to be leading the church in the right direction. He's cum petro sub petro. We're with him and under him. And so he's, you know, we have to trust that he's leading the church in the right way. That's what is primarily preventing them from really standing up and saying this is wrong, because you're standing up against the Pope. And this is why we're really in sort of uncharted territory. We've never really had a Pope, though we've had, you know, popes in the past who've caused a lot of problems. We've never had one that's really impinged on doctrine like this from the top. I think this is what sort of, you know, makes them very reluctant to speak out. But there are some, of course, and I think some will, but whether it's enough to really move the needle and swing back to a more conservative Pope, I think the longer this goes on, the more likely you are to get a sort of conservative successor to Pope Francis. But I'm beginning to think that as it goes on, it's almost as though I think people will start throwing in the towel and thinking, well, this has to be the way that God wants, and so we'll go along with it. That may be the case. Also, many of the cardinals are not the best formed. They haven't had all that great formation, and they've gone along very much with this willingness to get along with the world, you know, and to pacify it by the world and get along with it. And I think that's going to also play into this, and that'll stop them also from really taking up any real resistance. As somebody pointed out, after the council, it's almost as though the church put down her arms and let the world come in. And again, I think we're just reaping the fruits of that.
Well, one doesn't know what the Holy Spirit will do in the night time as they pray and sleep. So there's always scope for the miraculous. After all, no church believes in the miraculous more than the Catholic Church does, which is another good reason being a Catholic. Let me speak on behalf of unformed Catholics and ask you a question about about the magisterium, because people are talking about throwing the towel in. They're talking about, well, becoming Orthodox or just giving up or finding some other ecclesial community that's going to at least defend Christian ethics. And one of the reasons that people are panicking, it seems, is the fear that Pope Francis and Archbishop Fernandez will succeed in changing the magisterium. And then, given that one of the great gifts of the Catholic Church is the development of doctrine and the whole notion of infallibility in its particular technical way, it's been expressed, offering a degree of confidence in the leading of God. The anxiety is, well, if these people are in charge and they do change the Catholic Church, that becomes a magisterium. It seems to me that this might be a case of the Sabbath being made for man and not man for the Sabbath, the magisterium being made for the church and not the church for the magisterium. And I can conceive of a period 50 years away when, having been through a most dreadful period of time and discovering that the new sexual ethics don't work, they don't work either to produce holiness or sanity or stability, and that Catholics might look back and say, well, first of all, infallibility wasn't evoked. It couldn't be, because you can't get that level of unanimity about these matters, with the church still highly divided. And secondly, that was bad magisterium. We need to be able to distinguish between authentic and inauthentic development, and that was inauthentic development for reasons that we'd have no difficulty in setting down on a postage stamp. Do we have to be afraid that Pope Francis and Archbishop Fernandez, together with their protégés, have the power to change magisterium forever? Or can we theologically, as Catholics, see a means by which, if they fall into this kind of error, it could be corrected at a later stage, but the church still remaining Catholic?
Mm. On a brighter note about this, I think there's a lot of people who often say, I've heard over the years, you know, well, what's the Pope actually changed? What's he actually really changed in the church's teaching? And it's not easy to see something that he's really concretely changed. And again, it goes back to this whole change in pastoral practice rather than changing the teaching. And so it's all very subtle. And just as it's been subtly changed, if you like, it could probably be easily corrected. I don't know. I mean, I've not spoken to anyone about that. Certainly canonically, canon lawyers say a lot of this can be corrected by a new pope if they wanted to bring things back to apostolic tradition.
If we look at the lessons that Anglican offers, Anglicanism doesn't have a magisterium, but it has a kind of it has a kind of cultural impetus, I suppose. The line that once crossed, from which there was no return, was the ordination of women to the priesthood. There are some practical as well as philosophical reasons for that. But if one deals with the practical ones alone for the moment, because they're simpler and less tendentious, the simpler reasons were that all the women ordained were feminists, because that's not a criticism. It's simply that for three generations, they, their mothers and their grandmothers had been imbued in secular feminism, and there was nothing within Anglicanism that allowed them the theological tools to ask questions about it. In fact, quite the opposite. Anglicanism simply adopted it wholesale without any discrimination. And the being feminists, they then brought to the church things that feminism is predicated upon, which is a degree of relativism in particular, and then some other less helpful things like profoundly inclusive maternal pro-gay agenda, which might not necessarily have been inevitable, but turned out to be. If the Catholic Church doesn't ordain women, then presumably there's some hope, as you so helpfully suggest, that it's just a matter of changing pastoral practice, pastoral atmosphere, cultural preference. Nothing's actually been done. That sounds to me like quite a hopeful analysis. It will take a while to move not only to the abolition of celibacy, but the ordination of women, wouldn't it? That couldn't happen very quickly, even if this particular generation of 60s diehards were determined on it.
No, and I think a lot of people also take hope from the Amazon Synod, because the Amazon Synod was all geared up to bring in women deacons and a married clergy. And this was the great fear among some that this synod was going to bring all that in. And in the end, the Pope at the 11th hour almost said, no, we're not going to do this. That upset a lot of the people who are pushing for that. He did leave the door open, though. So, you know, the debate goes on. But at the end of the day, nothing happened. There was no concrete change. There was nothing really done about it. And you could argue about this, you know, with a lot of this pontificate, there's been all these sort of concerns that these things would go through, and they never have. And perhaps when they do, I was talking to somebody not long ago who said, you know, if he does try to change these, he'll come up against the wall of the Holy Spirit, and he won't be able to get further. And I think that's where the difference is between, say, the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church, of course, in the sense that we hope and pray that we do have that guarantee in the Catholic Church that she cannot be led into error, and that, you know, that is a sort of guarantee for us that, you know, we're going to be okay. And so I think there is hope in that sense. And as I say, I don't think the synods, for all their threats and all the concerns and suspicions that that's what's going to happen, may never come to pass. We'll just have to see in this next one. They're certainly giving it the best shot, though.
They are. I mean, every so often they suggest we have precedents to look at, and the precedent is the Continental Synod, which I've forgotten exactly how many 0.0000% of the Catholic worshippers it drew in, but it was beyond minuscule. One of the things that it seems to me as an underinformed observer is that Pope Francis is more committed to the defense of people who appear to represent a homosexual culture than he is to the interests of feminism and the ordination of women. In other words, he seems to have infuriated some of the German feminists by not backing them in their calls for ordination to the diaconate and the priesthood, whereas he continues to be, some would say, over-affirmative to people who've been involved in the homosexual culture. Now, the first of all, is that true? And the second question I want to ask really is about Archbishop Fernandez, who's the heir apparent, and he's 60 instead of 84, and therefore is going to be around a lot longer. And so I want to ask whether or not the same agenda applies to him. But let's start perhaps with my analysis of the Pope's own spiritual preferences. Did you share that, or do you see something different?
Yes, no, I think it's a good point, Kevin. I can't really give an explanation for it. It's certainly something that he's pushed throughout his pontificate, is this sort of change of view on regarding homosexuals particularly. It's a little odd because people said, you know, that he's not that way inclined at all himself, and yet he seems willing to champion this cause. And I think it has a lot to do with the people around him, though. I think the priests around him, his advisors, tend to be pushing this quite strongly. And so I think that plays a role. one can't excuse him, though. I think he's been leading from the front, too, about this. You know, even this theology of love, which they've been trying to push through for many years, coming from the German church originally, is all geared to this, to making it, to normalizing homosexuality in the church. And that's, and, you know, he's just given the green light by either not acting or giving clear gestures of approval and words of approval.
So if we go on to talk about Archbishop Fernandes, but before you and I met today, I read through his book on the kiss. I also read his defense of himself, which I thought was really quite reasonable. He said, look, I wrote this when I was 30. I was attempting to catechize teenagers. No grown-up should be held accountable for books they wrote when they were 30. And if we let him off that for a moment, there are more serious charges that he spent quite a lot of time defending clergy whose involvement in sexual abuse was beyond doubt. And if there's one sin that almost everybody agrees on as being reprehensible in the extreme, it's the extent to which clergy who have abused minors have been protected by the institution. If he has a track record of that, wouldn't that cause some difficulty? There have been some victim survivors groups who've been very quickly saying, if the Pope means what he says about looking after the wounded, this is not an appointment that will please those who've been most wounded.
Well, this is a big question. Also, I thought it was interesting, the Pope's letter that he sent to Archbishop Fernandes on his appointment was very clear in saying, well, you know, even though the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith deals with these cases, I'd rather you dealt with the issues of faith rather than abuse cases, because that's something that I want priority with and you're better qualified to deal with. And of course, that suits him because of this poor record he has of dealing with the abuse cases. So it's almost as though the position he's been given is very tailored and fashioned for him. And to avoid that sort of awkwardness of, you know, the problems that he's had in dealing with abuse. So it kind of gives him a let out there, if you like. But I think there is a problem. And of course, that was reported on quite widely over the weekend about this mishandling in the past.
Is there any possibility? Well, obviously, we don't know the answer to this, but I think probably just in terms of taking the temperature of the politics of the Catholic Church, I mean, one thing that does unite most Catholics is their shame and their horror about the fact of abuse, whatever you put it down to, almost as much shame and horror about the fact that those people who are responsible for the abusers have covered it up. Is this something that the Pope and Archbishop Fernandes can weather, given that secular culture as well as Catholic culture sees this as one stop short of a blasphemy against the Holy Spirit? It really is a pretty serious misdemeanor.
It is. And I think what causes a lot of concern is that Francis has, well, generally covered up for his friends, Bishop Zanchetta, Archbishop Fernandes now. You know, he's more willing to promote his friends and gloss over or ignore any abuse when it comes to his friendships. So this is not a good track record for him. Of course, the mainstream media don't ignore this because they don't like to criticize Francis. But that is a big question mark over his record in this sense. And also the other aspect to this is, as we were saying earlier about his whole sort of trying to normalize homosexuality in the church, or at least indirectly doing so. Of course, though it's open to debate, I think it's fairly clear that there's a connection between clerical sex abuse and homosexuals in the priesthood. Now, he has spoken out, to be fair, Francis, about saying that the priesthood is no place for homosexuals, but at the same time, he gives this sort of mixed signals without, as we said at the beginning, reaffirming the church's teaching on any of this. Again, it's all the sort of, as often has been said, that the Pope, you've got to look at his actions rather than his words. His words can be very affirming in orthodoxy in some ways, but his actions speak differently. And I think it's the same when dealing with abuse.
Some people have described this as an expression of Argentinian culture and Argentinian politics. One thing I'd like to ask you to finish with, really, is the mechanics of the synodal process.
Yes.
So we, first of all, you know, as you very helpfully traced it back to the Synod on the Family, but we had the continental stage, and it's clearly been used as any practical, politically minded person knew that it would be, to set down some expectations. You know, we've taken the temperature of the church, and it says the following. And therefore, now, since it says the following, here's the next stage, we're going to build on that. In the absence of Catholics worldwide looking at Instrumentum Laboris and saying, yes, yes, this speaks for us, global warming, economic injustice, and wars all over the place, these are the things that inform our Catholic faith more than anything else. If that doesn't happen, does the synodal process have the mechanical legislative power to change doctrine as well as practice? Or is it just an exercise in pastoral fluff and psychodrama?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about the synods is that in the past, until Francis, they were really just a chance for the bishops to be consultants to the Pope and to advise him on what could be best be done. And I think with Francis, it's become more like, I mean, it is in a sense like a parliament, although they often deny it is a parliament. It is a bit like that. But at the end of the day, it is the Pope who decides. It's the Pope who's going to write the apostolic exhortation at the end of this synod. And as happened with the Amazon Synod, he may back down from actually going as far as it seems they want to go. But it is up to him at the end of the day. So all this can be a lot of talking, and that's why I do get concerned that it is a bit of a scandal when they're talking about all these issues which may never actually see the light of day in the church's teaching, and the church's teaching will not change. So it can be, in the meantime, rather a scandal to the faithful to hear all of this. I mean, like the Newswires put out this headline last week that the working document said that the Vatican, they put the working document in the voice of the Vatican, saying the Vatican is promoting radical inclusion of LGBT groups. Of course, it wasn't the Vatican, it was this synod document. But it's this sort of mood music that it puts out, which I think can be, I think for many of the faithful and many of the non-faithful, is very damaging to the church. But just to talk about the methodology, Gavin, what we haven't talked about is how interesting it is that they're now talking about this conversation in the spirit. It's actually aimed at deterring polemical debate and toning down the polarization, which I think is very interesting, because what they're trying to do, it seems to me, is try to placate the opposition, try to calm down any kind of opposition to this agenda by bringing out this conversation in the spirit. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because clearly that's what they want to do. It means offering us a viable alternative to polarization. But, you know, if you're dealing with truth and untruth, and you're dealing with truth and falsehood, as it were, you're going to get polarization and you're going to get division. If you're going to rule that out, then you're going to have a rather strange debate, I think.
Well, I think one of the things I want to say is that on the back of what you've said, which I think is quite hopeful, is that if this is a theological charade and it's capable of being exposed and exploded by discerning criticism, however unwelcome that is to the authors of it, then there's a role for you and I to play in serving and helping the church, because that's what we think we're doing. And it may very well be that if what we write is true, it will commend itself to people's hearts and minds. I think that's one of the first things I take away from it. The second thing, of course, is that the whole problem with inclusion and relativism is that it immediately rules out any act of judgment or discernment. One's not able to make a decision between that which is good and that which is not good, because everything is good. And if it's not good, it's because it's been alienated, and we need to draw it closer in rather than further away. So once more, the great trick of this document has been to set the whole thing up in the kind of language, both therapeutic and political, which stops some questions being answered and moves you inevitably towards certain other conclusions. And as you quite rightly say, one of the questions that is not allowed to be answered is which spirit is behind this, because there's more than one spirit. and that's, as you say, that's not allowed. One of the things I'd like to end with, I think, is probably to go back to Newmarket and horses and gambling. And since you're the expert on the papabile stakes, and I know it changes, and you're not committing yourself to having the same view in 6 months' time. But if, having written a book on the runners coming up to succeed Pope Francis, this is impossible, and we're only doing this in order to lighten the tone, because I think the tone needs to be lightened. Who would your three front runners be to succeed the Pope when God rests him from the burden of his labours on earth?
Well, I think one of the leading candidates at the moment, certainly from the sort of more conservative wing, which there is an argument that it'll swing back to a more conservative wing, certainly somebody with a quieter, safe pair of hands, would be Cardinal Peter Erdo of Budapest, who's a good canonist and somebody who people say, well, we do need a good canonist to put all this correct, to correct all of this. So that's probably one of the leading candidates. Then you've got, and he was actually somebody who Cardinal George Pell, of course, was very keen on, and I thought he had a good chance. There's still also Cardinal Tagley, who's he's still quite young. I think he's seen as, he was at one point Pope Francis's personal favorite to become his successor. And then also coming up through the ranks, who I wasn't in my book, but who I think some people do think has a good chance, is Cardinal Arborelius of Sweden, who is a Carmelite convert people speak very highly of. And another candidate who I think is sort of under the radar, but being pushed, I think, by the sort of Francis side, those who want continuity with Francis, is Cardinal José Mendonça, Portuguese cardinal, who's head of the Dicastery for Catholic Education and Culture. He's only in his mid-50s or late-50s, and so he's also somebody that they're pushing through, somebody who'll certainly keep much of the priorities that Francis has, I think. So yeah, so those are probably the four, I'd say, actually, who are leading palpably in my book. But it's such a parlor game, you never know who's going to really lead this. But they have to have a certain amount of notoriety, in the sense that people need to know about them. And I think these people are quite well known now.
Well, if I was a gambling man, I'd go and put some money on it. But you and I, were, as it turns out, accidentally were educated at the same school, though not at the same time, as I'm much more decrepit than you are. And when I was 15, I snuck out of school to a local bookie and decided I would try my hand at gambling. And I put a shilling on a horse to win. And I thought, if this wins, then I will decide I have lucky fingers and I'll give it another go. But if it loses, I will never gamble again in my life. And it lost. So I won't be going out to put £10 on Cardinal Erdo. But for those of you who do consider yourselves have lucky fingers, you could hardly have better inside information than that coming from Edward Penton. Edward, thank you so much for taking the time and trouble. Lovely talking to you. I'm very grateful. God bless.
You too. Thank you, Gavin. God bless.